Archaeology. Rocks. What do we have? What do we have in rocks?
Scriptures.
Scriptures, writings. Buddhist archaeology. What have we got? The Buddhist archaeology of India. UQ.net.au. So what Buddhist archaeologist Diggins Club, Victor Gunasekara. There you go. There's a site on that. I haven't looked like that. Yep.
Buddhism is based on Dhamma, right? So even if the archaeologist, the idea of a Buddha, that somehow someone must have taught this path, does it really matter if there's not such hard evidence for a Buddha? The fact that the whole idea of Buddhism is based on Dhamma.
And what's the Dhamma?
The Dhamma is whoever believes in this way, you practice it like an experiment. You put into practice some teachings and it works. So you put into practice more and then you experience more and more, let's say.
And you experience the method of doing bhikkhuni ordination?
So you do need
there are men and women, there are men monks, there are women monks.
Okay, let's have a bit of a survey or summary of the archaeological evidence. Now, in the time of the Buddha, and from the time of the Buddha, we have precisely no archaeological evidence. No monasteries, no inscriptions, no statues, no monuments, nothing.
Yes, he was born in Limbini.
The earliest important hard archaeological evidence we have is from the time of Ashoka. And there we have, of course, the Ashokan pillars and the Ashokan inscriptions, and from those we learn a number of things. We learn that there was a very mighty and powerful emperor whose domain was pretty much all over there, and all there and down here, except for a bit in the south there, and pretty much everywhere you see. And he was a Buddhist, and tried to have a Buddhist policy in India with a great degree of success, so we know that. We know that he referred to the Sangha of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in politically correct language. He always referred to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis together, never referred to bhikkhus just alone. He refers to a group of texts.
That's right.
Okay, so let's see. I should find it somewhere. So there's a picture of Ashoka. Edicts.
That's right, he also invented veterinary.
Okay, so on here is the silver punch mark coins of the Mauryan Empire. There's an elephant on there. There's a very cute little elephant, I have to admit. The Bodhi tree and the stupa, and I say the Dhammacakka, and so on. So there's different kinds of things. Here's where the Ashokan. There's this edicts found in that area. Okay, so it's a massive empire. Remembering that as well as that, he was very closely allied, certainly with the Sri Lankans and possibly with the south of India as well. So that was the biggest Indian empire ever, basically until the British, really.
No Ashokan edicts in Sri Lanka.
No Shoganese in Sri Lanka. Yeah.
Just made that.
So here I mentioned before that he mentioned the rulers of various countries, and so here's the rulers which he mentioned in his edicts. Blah blah blah. Conversion. National alliance. No. I was trying to find the texts that he wrote. No. So here's a picture of one of the Ashokan edicts, the pillar edicts. That's the Ashokan Brahmi characters. So again, this, you know, the significance of this, the importance of this, is the earliest actual concrete evidence we have of Buddhism. Yeah, and sorry, not of the Buddha, no. But he says things like, 20 years after his coronation, beloved of the gods, King Piyadasi visited this place and worshipped, because here the Buddha, the sage of the Sakyans, was born. Okay, so this phrase here, he quotes Ihe Buddhe Jate, which is actually a quote from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. He had a stone pillar and a figure and a pillar set up, which still exists, and because the Lord was born here, the village of Limbini was exempted from tax and required to pay only 1/8 of the produce.
What was it before?
What's Shogun's argument against these descriptions?
Oh, he would basically say that they're very fragmentary, and so that doesn't really prove very much. It just proves that Ashoka respected a teacher called the Buddha, but it doesn't really tell you very much about what the Buddha's actual teachings are. The Dhamma of Ashoka is, generally speaking, a kind of ordinary ethical Dhamma which has not got a lot to do with Buddha's teachings. He doesn't talk about dependent origination and emptiness and these kinds of things. He just talks about doing good, being kind to people, and so on. Yeah. So he does mention a group of Buddhist texts, which is what I'm just trying to find now. Precepts of right behaviour, benevolence, kindness to prisoners. He abolished capital punishment, and so on. This is okay. Here we go. Here's the things. Blah blah blah. Major rocket edict. Okay. These Dhamma texts. Okay. So King Piyadasi, king of Magadha, saluting the sangha, and wishing them good health and happiness, speaks thus. You know, reverend sirs, how great my faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is. Whatever, reverend sirs, has been spoken by the Lord Buddha, all that is well spoken. So, Piyadasi was the way that he referred to himself. Because of the style of the Shokan inscriptions, it's generally accepted that these are probably direct dictations by the king. Okay, it's in a kind of a rough, kind of informal style. It's not like really kind of polished. And so it's probably someone took like direct shorthand from what he said and then later on carved them down. These Dhamma texts, the extracts from the discipline, Vinaya Samukamsa, the noble way of life, Aryavamsa, the fears to come, Anagata Bhayani Sutrani, the poem on the silent sage, Maneya Sutra, the discourse on the pure life. What's called pure life? What's what that one is? I'm not sure what that is. Upatisha's questions, the questions of Sariputra, and the advice to Rahula, which is the Rahula Vada Sutra, spoken on the subject of false speech. These Dhamma texts reference says, I declare that all the monks and nuns, notice his politically correct language, may constantly listen to and remember, likewise the laymen and lay women. So, here, notice what he's saying. He's saying everything that's spoken by the Buddha is well spoken. So he seems to be referring to a body of accepted canon and scripture of some kind, but without telling us what exactly that was. And then he's naming a few specific texts which he's particularly recommending. So it's like the first Dhamma curriculum, if you like. Now, of course, there's been much scholarly ink spilt on what exactly these are. What is certain is that the texts are pretty much found within the Pali canon and similar literature, And there's no need to look outside of the Pali canon for other things. For example, there's no Abhidhamma text, there's no Mahayana text, there's none of these kind of later things. They're obviously all sutra kinds of things. One problem is that the early sutras are not particularly consistent in terms of their titles. Even within the Pali tradition, you might find several titles for the same sutra, so it's not always possible to identify them. But nevertheless, most of these have been identified with one or other sutra. This one, Rahulavada Sutra on False Speech, is obviously the Majjhima Nikaya discourse, the Noble Way of Life. Aryabhasani is one of perhaps two or three sutras, so there's a Aryabhasa Sutta of the Anguttara. Anagatabhayani Sutrani is in the Anguttara. The Manaya Sutra is found in the Sutta Nipata. Patissa's
and so on. Do you like that one about training? On training? We did it a little while ago.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure. I can't remember what the Pali is for that, so I can't remember exactly what that one is now. And so on. So this is the earliest mention by name of some Buddhist texts, and there's certainly the same kinds of texts that we find today in the Pali canon and the similar early literature. Okay, so we can't prove that the Pali canon existed exactly in the form that we have it, but we do know that a similar kind of literature existed. Okay, so that's a good piece of evidence. And what other evidence do we have?
What about, you know, people that remember past lives?
People remember past lives?
But I guess not the solid people, but just as a reassurance, I know that...
Yeah.
That
he learnt them from much later. He learnt the text from the time of Buddha Gosa.
He didn't remember the time.
No.
It
could potentially, yeah. Potentially.
Haven't we spent a year doing the sutras and proving everything all the time, week after week, and singing it?
And singing, yeah. We have, Eva. But I want to go back. What other evidence do we have? That's not anything. So far, if we take the evidence that's really solid so far, the unity of the scriptures proves that they were together before the school split up. But if that was the time of Ashoka or a bit afterwards, we're talking 100 or 200 years after the Buddha. Similarly, the Ashokan edicts, this is like 150 years after the Buddha. So we've taken it back, if we like, to reasonably, 100, 200 years, but that's not really that reassuring. We still haven't shown that it's actually spoken by the Buddha. So what other evidence do we have? So a lot of the secular details that we find in the suttas, the economics, the politics, the geography, they can also be dated. Okay, so some of the specific details that we have there is, as far as geography goes, that the early suttas only talk about this area here, basically, from Anga down here up to about here. And yeah, they go up to Kuru once or twice, and down here they talk about once or twice. So basically just this area. And there's no mention of south of India. And so, but you can see in the later text a gradual expansion of geographical knowledge. Obviously, by the time of Ashoka, he's referring to the Greeks and all of these kinds of things all the time. So that the knowledge of geography expanded rapidly, but within the suttas itself is still quite limited. So that's one point. Another point is, as Daryl mentioned, is the politics of the area. In the time of the Buddha, and the suttas are depicted in a time with the two rival kingdoms of Magadha and Kosala, and then the various republics of the Shakyans and the Rajputikas and so on, and another kingdom down here, Ujjaini and so on. And that political situation was only relevant for a fairly short period of time within Indian politics. Soon afterwards, Magadha was very rapidly expansive and conquered that whole region. So that political model only applied to within the Buddha's time and a few generations either side. Another very important political detail is the ownership of Kasi or Benares. And if you look in all of the Jatakas, Benares is an independent kingdom with its own with the king Brahmadatta of Benares, and that's one of the reasons why the Jatakas are dated to a time before the Buddha, because they're from a time when Benares was an independent kingdom. But King Pasenadi's grandfather, I think father or grandfather, we call him Mahakosala, conquered Kasi. And from that time onwards in Indian history, Kasi or Benares was never an independent kingdom again. Okay? Now in the time of the Buddha, Benares was being fought over by Kosala and Magadha. Okay? So we know that Kosala conquered Kasi before the Buddha, we know that Magadha gained control of Kasi after the Buddha, and we know that in the time of the Buddha they were disputing it. Okay? So again, that's a political detail which tends to cement that. We know another political detail is that at the end of the Buddha's life, Ajatasattu was building the defences in Pataliputta, looking forward to conquering the Vajiputtikas and so on. And we know that that happened in subsequent years. So the political details are confirmed by comparisons with, say, the Upanishads and so on. Tend to reinforce that idea. Another detail is details in terms of the development of society and so on. For example, in the it's a more urbanized society. So you've got a more urbanized society depicted as opposed to the Buddhism of earlier years, and yet you don't find the situation of later years with a large empire over the whole of India. So that's another detail. Another detail is the trading, yeah. Yeah, trading and using currency and so on. Yeah, and that was again, you know, if you look in the later literature, the trading goes over a much wider area. For example, there's no mention of trading by boats in the suttas, which is very commonly mentioned in the later literature, Jatakas and things. So, politics, geography, the economy. The existence of writing. So we hardly find writing mentioned in the early texts at all. There's one or two mentions which are probably mentions of writing, but there's no mention of actual writing down of texts, of religious texts. They were probably just personal letters and things, or writing may have been early used for trade purposes. And so, again, in the later literature we find writing mentioned constantly, but in the early literature it's not mentioned. So there's some of the reasons why we want to locate the suttas in that period at that time. I've just mentioned a few other things which are also relevant. One is that regarding the Pali Canon, that we know that it was taken to Sri Lanka, say at the time of Mahinda or a little bit afterwards, right? But the interesting thing about the Pali Canon is that it's got almost nothing Sri Lankan about it. Okay, there's one or two little bits and pieces here tacked on at the end. There'll be a little colophon at the end of a chapter, and it'll say this was added by, or this is the vinaya according to the text of the Mahavihara Vasans of Sri Lanka. But that occurs just in very marginal places once or twice. Basically, the Pali Canon was fixed in India. It's an Indian dialect, not a Sri Lankan dialect. So that means it must have been fixed in India. Many people say it's probably fixed around this area. And it must have been canonical enough. It must have been fixed enough already that when they took it to Sri Lanka, it would have been very easy to adapt it to the old Sri Lankan dialect, which was very similar to Pali in those days. So it would have been very easy to just slip over into a Sri Lankan, which is what happened in most other places. When they took it to Gandhara, they put it in the Gandhari dialect and so on. So the fact that it remained fixed in the Indic language suggests that it already was established quite well for quite a time in India, enough so that there was perceived that the language couldn't be changed. Yeah? So this is another reason, the very minor quantity of Sri Lankan influence on the Pali Canon is another strong piece of evidence.
The fact that it was kept in the Indic language could have just been a fundamentalist mentality of individuals.
It could It could be, but even that fundamentalism has to have something to feed on. It has to feed on a perception that it is in some way canonical. Yeah. Yeah. The Jaina texts refer occasionally to the Buddha, but they are dated from a much later date. And the Upanishads, which are dated from a similar date as the Buddha, I'm not aware of any early Upanishads that explicitly refer to the Buddha, although they do adopt Buddhist doctrines. And the Hindu texts and so on, which do refer to the Buddha from a later date. It's kind of neither supports nor doesn't support. It's just a kind of absence of evidence. Yeah. I mean, there's no particular reason to suppose that they should do. I mean, I'll write a book on Buddhism and there's no particular reason why I should refer to what's happening at the local Christian church down the road, you know? I might do, and if I do, then that will be some evidence for that, but I may well not. This doesn't really prove anything. The fact that I don't doesn't really prove anything. Yeah? Yeah? Yeah.
The Buddha spoke of other sects and other texts. Don't believe other texts.
Yeah, don't believe it comes in because it's passed down in the Pitaka. Yeah.
Yeah. So there must have been referring to some.
Yeah, so the Buddha was aware of other writing. He's certainly aware of the Vedas and some of the later Brahmanical literature, and that's referred to quite often in the Pali. Whether there was any other literature is not sure. Yeah. So he was aware of other literature, but this is the question is then whether other literature is aware of the Buddha. That's another question.
Suggested in those inscriptions.
Yeah.
That there was some things written down.
Yeah.
That was 150 years after.
Oh, so you're saying that there was written texts available? Is that what you're trying to suggest? The texts referred to in the Kalama Sutra are just oral texts. Okay, so the word like the Pitaka or something like that is just referring to an oral text in that case. Yeah, there's no need to assume that it was a written text. Yeah, and the same with Ashoka, he's just referring to certain scriptures, and his inscriptions don't prove themselves whether they were oral or written, but the internal evidence of the traditions say that the texts weren't written down till much later. So there may have been isolated texts written down earlier, but not the whole canon. The main passing down was by oral literature. Yeah.
Is there some reason that I think I read
It's hard to say. There's no really explicit reasons given. Certainly, that was the case within the Vedic tradition, that they sort of had this kind of fierce protectiveness around them. That they, you know, if you were a sudra and you heard the Vedas by accident, you'd have your tongue ripped out. Right. So, in Buddhism, it doesn't really say. My feeling is that it was mainly just because that was the custom. And I think that they probably also, it's just something about learning it by heart. That you were supposed to learn it by heart. You're supposed to know it in your heart. You're not supposed to know it in a text. And that wasn't felt in any way to be an inferior way of doing it. Certainly there was an association of writing with profane literature. It was probably mainly used for trade and for things like government declarations and stuff like that. There's actually a very interesting story in the commentary to the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta where it talks about a gift of kings. And there's one king gives a gift to another king. One of them was, who was it, Bimbisara, and one was, what was his name now? His name, Dharavibhanga Sutta?
Pokarasati.
Pokarasati, yeah. And Pokarasati sends Bimbisara a gift, and then Bimbisara thinks, what can I give him that's the most valuable gift? And he says, well, the word of the Buddha is the most valuable thing in my realm. So he writes down on gold leaf a lot of suttas. Mm. Which is actually very plausible, because gold leaf is a very good writing material. And and sent it with a caravan, trading caravan, to Pokorosati. And so that's quite intriguing. So there certainly are kind of copper inscriptions and things from later years. So it'd be interesting if something like that was done and was buried in a stupa somewhere, then you might even find...
Did Alexander and his troops bring back any sort of evidence at all about
that? That's disputed, yeah. There's not the kind of clear and unambiguous evidence which you'd kind of want to find. They did apparently have some discussion with certain kind of gymnosophists and so on, but not sure whether, like I said, they were Buddhists. I mean, Alexander and his mates basically came and
smashed
things and then went away and died. But they did set up kingdoms and so on. Yeah, it's disputed.
You know, pupil
of Aristotle, yeah. Well, look, if he'd hung around for a bit longer, but I think he had other things on his mind. He was only in India for a fairly short time, and his army was rebelling against him and all of this kind of stuff. But, I mean, there obviously was intellectual exchange in later years, but, I mean, it is a little bit curious that there's not more kind of clear connection. But maybe... Mark Allen suggested that maybe they were like in different social strata. That may have been one of the differences.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you write with gold leaf?
How do you write with gold leaf?
You write with it or you write on it?
You write on it, yeah. Just scratching on it. Yeah.
Scratch the gold off.
No, you hammer it thin, hammer a gold plate thin and then just inscribe it.
Oh, copper. You've got a picture that's done that. Mm-hmm. Somebody gave you a...
Yeah, just in engraving, yeah, engraving on the gold leaf.
Embossing.
Embossing, yeah? Isn't embossing like stamping it?
Stamping,
but stamping, I think engraving, yeah. Gold leaf is, thanks. Gold leaf is very good because it doesn't tarnish. You can beat it very thin. Gold was quite common in India. It wasn't that rare until the British took it all. And, it's very soft, so it's easy to engrave. So it's actually an ideal writing material for those who can afford it. It would just be gold on gold.
Engraving.
Oh, you just have to look at it in the light or something like that. I mean, you might dye it or something, but the basic engraving would just be gold on gold.
But the engraving requires that metal be removed from the surface.
Yeah.
Embossing actually means to imprint into it.
Imprinting to it.
It's called embossing.
Yeah. Yeah, so I couldn't show exactly the method, but anyway. So anyway, this is a book on ancient Buddhist scrolls from Gandhara. This is another piece of evidence that's come up in recent years. This is work done by Mark Allen, among others, and these pots like this, dug out of the dirt in Gandhara and Afghanistan and places, and inside the pots is here's like a monastery cell, monastic cell, yeah. And then inside there are various manuscripts like this, often birch bark, and written on, and so these have been, when they were recovered, were sort of rolled up tightly like these things, and so they had to sort of very laboriously and carefully unroll them and try to make sense of them. So this is the work that's still ongoing. A few of these sutras have been published. And so what you do is you go to Afghanistan, dig around, find that kind of jar, get out of that.
Don't give it to your granddad.
Find the manuscripts in there rolled up in things like that, pull them out like that, spend years gradually moistening them and unrolling them, put them under glass plates to preserve them, photograph them, figure out how to decipher the writing, right? Then you figure out where all these little bits go, because you've got hundreds of little scraps and fragments all over the place. Put them down together, put them with the Gandhari, the Chinese, the Sanskrit and the Pali and so on, and try to reconstruct what the original thing went, and spend years and years and years working on a sutta, put them together, get the sutta, translate it, and then you say, oh yeah, it's pretty much the same as one of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya.
That's good. That's good. The
Yeah. And then Buddhists don't even pay attention, don't even bother paying attention to what you're doing.
That collection of books, the hundreds of dollars worth that you've got, blue, dark blue books,
mm-hmm.
that's what they all do with the Sanskrit.
Yeah, that's right.
When I got the Dalai Lama's teaching, Ajahn Atra, his sister, was working in Afghanistan as a journalist,
mm-hmm.
and she found in the market this old kind of rock that was had Buddhism carved in it,
mm-hmm.
and so she thought, well, since it's there's no longer any Buddhists there or anything,
mm.
so she managed to get it,
mm.
and she smuggled it back in,
mm.
and she offered it.
Okay. Was it a real one or a fake?
Yeah.
Real one. Oh.
Apparently.
There you go. So these manuscripts are now being, the earliest ones are dated to just after the beginning of the Common Era. So between the beginning, they've been carbon dated. And so actually carbon dated at ANU. So that's the earliest manuscript evidence. So the earliest actual physical evidence of Buddhist sutras. About the first century of the Common Era, so about 500 years after the Buddha. Yeah, this book is really good. It gives you all the kind of stuff there. So that's good. We've got a few reasons for why the Pali suttas are early. One is because they're similar to the Chinese and Sanskrit versions, because the state of political, economic, geographical knowledge is early, and other reasons we've mentioned. Okay, now I just want to look. One brief question is, why is the other stuff late?
That's right. Because as soon as you get the facilities to start writing stuff, you can write whatever you want.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at what the latest stuff is and what they actually wrote,
mm-hmm.
you can actually see they refer to writing,
mm-hmm.
in the
yep.
text. Like,
yep.
you should make copies of this text and put it on the shrine and worship it.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's very common in the Mahayana sutras.
Yes,
yeah.
So you need to make copies and worship it and all
yep.
that kind of stuff. So you can see that when you get to the point where you have lots of money and you have lots of support in order to do that, you can just sit down by yourself and write whatever you want.
Yeah.
And then from that,
you can say, and you started out with Thus Have I Heard.
Thus Have I Heard.
Even my Ashrutana. Absolutely. So that's one reason, especially Mahayana sutras very, very commonly refer to writing. And so that's one reason we know, because of the state of technology. And in fact, a modern trend in academic studies has been to associate the beginnings of Mahayana with that very fact. In other words, it was because of the fact that people could write whatever they want, that their imagination could be unleashed. And so a lot of the Mahayana sutras are felt to be inspired by meditation experiences which the monks were having, which were then filtered through the literary forms, which was the only literary forms which they knew, which was the form of the sutras, yeah, and was like their way of expressing their truth which they'd seen in meditation. And there's some of the Mahayana sutras that even talk about this, doing that. So that's one reason. What are other reasons why? Why do we know the Abhidhamma is late compared to the suttas? After all, we know that the Buddha went to Tavatingsa Heaven in the seventh rain retreat, taught the entire Abhidhamma to his mother.
Other philosophical influences? Something about
essentialism. Uh-huh. There is. Okay, so that's one point is like doctrinal development. Yeah.
The Abhidhammas of the different schools don't agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
He taught continuously for the 3 months, right?
So they say, yeah.
It'll be a long time up in that realm.
Yeah. Well, it'd take a long time. Yeah. Like they estimate. I think there's how many, like 50 billion questions or something in the Patana alone. So. Yeah, it'd take like.
You said that if they printed it with all its repetitions, the actual material would go from here to Melbourne.
Yeah.
The printed books.
Yeah. Yeah, just the Patana.
Just one book.
Just one book, yeah. That's just an estimate.
That's just an estimate.
So.
That's
So, yeah, doctrinal development is one thing. In the canonical Abhidhammas as such, the level of doctrinal development is actually quite minimal and is more implied than anything else. So what the Abhidhammas do is they take the basic doctrines which are taught from the suttas and then they arrange them, organize them, systematize them, and so on. And so it's originally more of a just a way of kind of presenting the sutta doctrines, but that way of presenting sutta doctrines has its own particular implications which got drawn out in the later texts, which is where the philosophical differences became more pronounced. But certainly the main reason for knowing the Abhidhamma is later is simply because it's entirely based on the suttas. It's an abstraction from the suttas and is based on it. Yeah?
So the suttas and the Vinaya never refer explicitly to the Abhidhamma.
But the Abhidhamma refers back to the suttas, yeah?
There's one, at least one mention, imagine if you have Abhidhamma, but itself is...
There's a few mentions of the word Abhidhamma, but it doesn't mean the text as such, it just means kind of...
It's the same as the canon refers to Theravada, but it doesn't necessarily mean...
In that context
means the school in which we're following the artist talk, since it has the word Theravada.
Yeah. So, okay, so there's a few reasons. The doctrinal development of the Abhidhamma is the important one. The development of the literary style. It's a very kind of large bodies of systematic literature.
They have authors?
In the Sarvastivadin and Dharmaguptaka ones, they are attributed to specific authors. And also, you know, you can see that the authorship of them is even kind of uneasily kind of mythologized within the Buddhist tradition. You know, you don't sort of straightforwardly say the Buddha went to Savatthi and there he taught the Dhammasangani. You say that he went up to the heaven, taught it there, and then came back and repeated it to Venerable Sariputta, who then repeated it to his disciples, and you're thinking, this is sounding a little bit dodgy. So there was an actual ongoing debate even within the Theravadin school about the authenticity of the Abhidhamma. So in the beginning of the Abhidhamma commentary in the Pali, there's actual record of a debate, of an argument, and it's quite funny actually, because one person saying, one monk says, oh, these Abhidhamma books are not authentic, and then the response to that is, well, you must have been sitting in the back of your Vinaya class just dozing and falling asleep, because not a modern phenomenon. So they were questioned, and they were questioned even much earlier. The Mahasanghika has rejected the Theravadin Abhidhamma and so on, so they weren't accepted across the schools. There is actually a lot in common between the various Abhidhammas, but there also are distinctive differences. So that's with the Abhidhamma. What about Mahayana Sutras? We've already heard that the Mahayana Sutras refer to writing, but what else do we know about the dates of the Mahayana Sutras? By their authors.
It's traceable to like one particular monk or one particular geographical area?
Not really. Rarely. Sometimes they can be geographically localized, and in those cases, for example, you know, you do find a widespread geographical area, like the Gandavyuha Sutta, goes over the whole of India and stuff, so that's, yeah, some geographical evidence there. But they typically don't have actual authors as such. What other reasons do we know? Why do we put the Mahayana Sutras dated later than the Pali Sutras? Is that just a prejudice? Is it just a sectarian bias?
Well, they have all those rites and rituals and all that. Maybe that's got something to do with it.
Rites and rituals?
Well, you know, things that they celebrate things and...
We can
get devotionally inspired with food to the Buddha.
Isn't that nice?
Well.
It doesn't mean that they're late. Maybe that's where maybe the Buddha liked that.
That the Mahayana's acknowledge it.
Not really, no. They claim that it was literally spoken by the Buddha and it was kept in the Naga realm for 500 years. So.
Is there any evidence that the Nagas read?
There, not. Well, I mean that does, I mean it is, apart from anything, it is based on the perception that, that the texts are written, yeah? So not only must that have been appeared after the texts were written, but also after it had been forgotten that they were earlier passed down in an oral tradition. So they must have been written down for quite a while already. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one reason. Yeah?
But also
language and the style. Language and the style, yeah? Which languages are they written in?
I don't know, I'm just guessing.
Sanskrit, yeah, okay. So they're very often they're composed in Sanskrit. And we know that Sanskrit was only formalized as a language after the Buddha. And that the Buddhist texts tend to evolve from something more like Pali towards something more like Sanskrit in later years. So the fact that some of the Mahayana sutras are written with an influence of what they call the Prakrit, so they're not all in pure Sanskrit, but most of them are pretty much in Sanskrit. So that's one style. The late literary style is another thing, and they tend to have these very kind of long, florid literary styles, which is only really possible from a verse, from a written format. Yeah. So they're written and they're not like the Pali sutras, which are composed obviously as oral literature and then later written down. They're obviously composed as written literature.
They were
actually composed as a written literature. So from stylistic and linguistic evidence, you can show that. So from the beginning, they must have been written.
What about the form that they used?
Yeah, but maybe they were written differently. They just knew again in a different way. Maybe others speak very differently. Sure they do,
but there's no evidence for that.
Well, there's no evidence, but then pragmatic evidence is sort of very worldly and very graspable and concrete.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean that more refined kind of evidence. It's like a mathematical proof, you know. You sort of let go of all the really chunky, heavy stuff and you get to the more refined realms of it.
More refined realms of it.
You don't need to rephrase and restate all of the earlier evidence that goes to building that proof. You just chop it all out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true to a certain extent, and the Mahayana sutras are built up like that, but what they're built up like on is on the early sutras. Yeah, so the basic stuff which they take for granted is actually the Agama sutras. So that's another reason to show that they were composed later.
But the Buddha wouldn't have forgotten if they were written, you know, he's going to be speaking in patterns, you know, he's not.
Yeah.
He's going to be repeating himself.
Yeah.
Even if it's a Naga speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not like saying, well, why wouldn't he repeat the argument in a different way? And, you know, he's that there's only four things.
Yeah, he can, and obviously within the arguments that there are lots of repetitions, so yeah, obviously that did happen, and no, there's no particular reason why that shouldn't happen, but what you do have and what's more significant and more telling is the fact that there's a process of doctrinal evolution which can be dated and make sense. And that process of doctrinal evolution goes from the Agama Sutra doctrines to the canonical Abhidhamma teachings to the post-canonical Abhidhamma treaties. And then the doctrines of the post-canonical Abhidhamma treaties are explicitly critiqued in the Mahayana Sutras using language which only was used in terminology and ideas which only evolved 300-500 years after the Buddha. And they're taken up and critiqued. Extensively.
It sounds like you're using the same things that you criticise.
Uh-huh.
Because you're justifying this kind of evolution and unfolding in terms of one way of seeing things.
Uh-huh.
But supposedly in the heavenly realms, things unfold in a different way.
Uh-huh.
You know, with different conceptual and time based phenomena.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it very different realms.
Yeah, like a bit more like
quantum physics and relativity. They're very different. They're very, very, very different.
A bit more like mythology than like physics.
You can't use the same tools, the same techniques. They just don't measure the same things.
Yeah. Anyone want to?
What about the like the style and the form of the language that has correspondences to other things that are written at that time, like non-Buddhist texts?
Yeah.
You can see the historical sort of time period in which it's created by the other stuff that was going on. So.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just saying that you're using the kind of observational apparatus which has to impose itself on that.
Yeah, it's a set of assumptions. Yeah, so it's a set of assumptions and a set of methodology. So it's just saying that, it's not saying that that's the kind of the be all and end all, but it's just saying that if we want to look at it, if we want to put some groundedness into Buddhism, then we use this methodology, and then these are the results that we get when we use that methodology. That's all. But it's certainly not saying, you know, and as you guys would know, I certainly wouldn't say that everything therefore in the Mahayana Sutras are therefore wrong. You know, if it's merely saying, well, where do we place them in terms of historical development? Once we've done that, then we can read them and then understand how they actually, what they mean and so on. Yeah? So I personally believe that a lot of their philosophical critiques of the Abhidhamma were in fact quite cogent. Yeah? So I'm not criticising them for that, but just sort of understanding them in the right way.
Critiquing their claims to authenticity, saying, this is the word of the Buddha.
Yeah. And the one of the things with that, and I think this is something which we often miss or we often underestimate, is this sense of lightheartedness and of play that there often is within Mahayana Sutras, but also ancient texts in general. I mean, the Pali Canon are full of kind of these kind of playful and kind of things which weren't necessarily meant to be taken literally at all. And that's actually quite common in ancient scriptures. And some of the Mahayana sutras are, you know, obviously meant as satires. Like the Vimalakirti Nirdesha is quite obviously like just a whole kind of series of jokes and stuff. And but then gets taken very seriously. But I don't think it was taken so seriously by its authors.
What about non-Buddhist elements and influences in texts.
Yeah.
There's emphasis on ritual.
Yeah. So that would apply probably more to, well,
maybe tantric.
Yeah, there's a uniformity, or a sort of reflection between the Buddhist texts and other stuff. So one obvious example would be the development of bhakti, kind of the devotional aspects, which it comes out in things like some of the Amitabha Sutras and some of the Mahayana Sutras, not all of them, which parallels the development of the bhakti movement in Hinduism, and similarly the tantric movement in Buddhism paralleled the tantric movement in Hinduism and so on.
Do they mention Buddhist statues?
Yeah.
That's not because Buddhist statues didn't exist until much later.
Yeah. So that's another thing, is the mention of images and things. Yeah. Earliest images around the beginning of the Common Era.
About 500 years or so.
Yeah, 400-500 years after the Buddha. Yeah, I mean, there are probably earlier ones in wood, but they're the earliest ones that have survived in stone.
The original image was a foot, and a wheel, and the empty seat of the Buddha.
Is that an iconic image that's used earlier?
Isn't there some sort of explicit prohibition on great images?
No, I don't think so. Sometimes it's said that there was, but I don't think there was. I think that's a reading from Judeo-Christian tradition, Islamic tradition. I've never found any serious prohibition on images of the Buddha. Yeah.
Does Mahayana really believe that the texts were in the Naga realm?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
What are they doing? Because, you know, in the Vinaya, one of the questions is, wasn't there a story that a person was a Naga and then the Buddha said, sorry, you can't become enlightened? So what are they doing in the Naga realm if it's useless for the Nagas because they can't get enlightened?
Couldn't be a monk.
But in any case, the Nagas They were just looking after them, that's all.
Nice little petties.
And that's it,
they
don't see any further
views.
Not really.
They're just like,
that's it.
They're just looking
after them. Like,
yeah.
What are they doing
and why? Yeah. Yeah.
Don't ask, believe.
Hmm.
So what else?
For Mahayana sutras. What else? Well, that's about all there is. I mean, really, you know, when you look at the kind of the language, the literary style, the social conditions, geographical knowledge, economic situation, political situation, doctrinal development, etc., etc., then there's not much left over. So it's one of the things with these kinds of analysis is that there's no one thing which tells us absolutely it must be here and can't be any other time. So any particular kind of evidence we use or line of argument we use can be questioned, and no doubt there's complexities and nuances and exceptions and all of these kinds of things for all of those. So what's really convincing actually is the combination of all of those different kinds of evidence from different fields, which taken together adds up to a fairly coherent picture. And you know, that consensus on the general idea of Buddhist, you know, evolution of Buddhist texts and so on has been established for about 150 years and hasn't really been seriously questioned since then, even though there's been a lot of new evidence come to light, even though it's been all of the comparison between the Pali and Chinese and so on was subsequent to that, these new evidence from Afghanistan and all of these inscriptions and everything was subsequent. But still, the original findings of the early generations of Indologists, Rhys Davids and Oldenburg and so on, is still more or less the basic framework that we work from. And those people who have questioned it on a more radical basis, of which there are very few, the main one being Gregory Chopin, their findings have not really been taken that seriously by, or their opinions haven't been taken that seriously by most scholars who are actually familiar with the evidence. And Chopin is big on opinions and says a lot of very interesting things and has some good arguments on many things, but in one of his basic points is trying to discredit the whole picture of early Buddhism. And if you look carefully at his writings on that, you'll find that he never makes basically any substantial acknowledgement of the kinds of arguments which we've been considering and which the early conclusions of the early Indologists were based. He simply ignores them basically, and doesn't really even show that he even knows what they are. So this is why most Pali scholars and so on don't take him very seriously, although a lot of people who don't know Pali and aren't familiar with the work of the early Indologists do take him seriously. So it is important to remember that even though we do dispute about these things, and even though we can have many different opinions on a particular text, a particular interpretation, and so on and so forth, that the findings of the scholars who've looked into it carefully have been, generally speaking, well accepted and understood and persistent for well over 100 years. And that includes both the Western scholars and also the Eastern scholars, and in particular the Japanese and Taiwanese scholars who've looked into it. So it's not a sectarian Theravadan point of view. Even the scholars from a Mahayanist background who have looked at these things from a historical point of view have come to essentially the same conclusions. And I think that's probably, you know, once you've reached that far, then there's maybe a few more things we can do. We can refine it and perfect it and sort out some particular areas of difficulty and these kinds of things, but after that we're pretty much riding on faith, yeah? And so from there on in, we're just sort of, if it works then it's good, so you can't push these things too far, yeah. So any more questions? Anya?
Like, does everybody
Mahayanists believe that the goal is like any rebirth, existence, suffering, eightfold path, noble truths, vinaya.
But much more specifically than that, I mean, all of the major teachings are identical in all the traditions, all the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Ten Origination, all of those things are always identical. And not only that, but even, as we discuss in our everyday sutta classes, hundreds and hundreds of suttas are also identical. So here's an example. So just a final thing here. Sujata is praised. Just by coincidence. Now, this is purely... okay, look, it just happens to be Beta Hunting number one. It's the first sutta. Okay, so they saw fit to put the sutta on the praise of Sujata. It's the first one of the collection. Who are we to question that? And here is... This is the... shrink it a bit. okay, so this is the version from the shorter Sangyukta Agama. Here's that version here.
Extraordinary beauty in Chinese.
I think this is probably the... this is the ordinary Sangyukta Agama version. So I can read that for us. It's a translation of the shorter Sangyukta Agama, and here's the Pali version here. And so that's what I heard. And once the... I'm trying to squeeze it. There you go. Okay, so this is just to give you an example of when we talk about the how close the different versions are. Let's give you a good example of that in a nice short sutta. That's what I heard. One time the Buddha stayed in a mango grove in the country of Mithila. Notice that Pali omits that introduction and just says Buddha's Savatthi Yang Viharati, dwelling at Savatthi. Now, at this time, the Venerable Sujata had just gone forth and cut off his hair. So that bit's not mentioned in here, in the Pali. Here it just says, and then Venerable Sujata approached the Blessed One where the Blessed One was. And here it says he came to the Blessed One, paid homage by touching the Buddha's feet and sat down on one side. The Buddha told the other monks. Now, here, while he's still off in the distance, the Buddha said to the other monks. Okay, so this is the actual quote of the Buddha's. This son of a good family, Sujata, is splendid in two ways. First, his appearance is of extraordinary beauty. His features exceptionally handsome. What's so funny? Second, he was able to cut off his hair and cover his body with a robe. Feeling deeply that family life was all too ephemeral, he went forth and pursued the way. He ended all afflictions, is filled with purity, has liberated his mind, has liberated his wisdom. In this body he has attained the unconditioned, forever ended the cycle of life and death, established in the pure life he will not have to endure another existence. So that's the translation of one of the Chinese versions, and here's the Pali. The monks, this son of a good family shines or is radiant in two ways. In as much as he is abhirupa, gorgeous, dasaniya, attractive, dasadika, charming or delightful, and is endowed with the supreme beauty of appearance. And in as much as he has realized that supreme goal of the holy life for which sons of good families rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness, and as in this very life, having realized it he with his own direct knowledge, he enters and abides in it, something like that. Anyway, so slightly different phrasing, but obviously the same idea. So this is what we mean when we say that the suttas have variations. We've got a different setting. It doesn't really affect the theme of the sutta. The introduction is mildly different. The content of the basic sutta is exactly the same, but the Chinese goes into a little bit more detail. And then they have some verses here. The monk, always calm and concentrated, abandons desire and life and death. He abides in his final body. He can defeat Mara's armies. Training his mind, he breaks all fetters. His uprightness is without equal. Okay, so
wow.
this is by Marcus Bingenheimer from Dhammadrum Mountain, and he's doing this thing. And I know I've spoken with him about the translations of these verses, because you have these five character Chinese. This is the form of the Chinese verses. These five character lines. It's compressed into that, so you have to get these eight syllable.
Eight syllable
Pali lines, if that is, but anyway. So Sobati Vatayam Bhikkhu, this monk shines. This doesn't have a word for shining here, probably calm and concentrated. Vatayam Bhikkhu Ujubhutena Jetasa, with a mind always upright. So here's the uprightness down here. Vipayuto Vipasamyuto, this is training, breaking all fetters. Anupadaya Nibhuto, without desire he's attained Nibbana. It's probably this bit somewhere. Dharati Antamang Dehang, he bears his final body. He abides in his final body. And Jetwa Marang Savahinanti, he has defeated Mara's armies. So the verse is very similar, given the strictures of translating from Indic into Chinese and then Chinese into English.
Yeah.
And so this is a typical example, and of course many thousands of other examples of suttas that are similar.
And this one just came out. And the little bracket, who adds that in, and I was using read them out, and they come across
Greek
on the suttas.
Yeah.
Like,
usually, the convention is if the bracket is a square bracket,
yeah,
then it's added by the translator or the editor.
Okay.
Yeah?
Like in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, sometimes you put something in brackets, that means it's not in the Pali, but to add or help.
Sometimes to clarify. Yeah.
Sometimes to,
I mean, sometimes you wonder whether it's necessary. In this case, he's liberated his mind, he's liberated his wisdom. Yeah, I mean, if you say he's liberated his mind from desire and liberated his wisdom from ignorance, yes, that's an accurate gloss on that, but whether it's necessary.
Very nice. Will you tick the tip and you will tell your name, or do you tick the tip? Tell us the story of your name.
The story of my name? Well, I should think it's obvious why it was chosen. But no, I think it was chosen by Ajahn Pasano because of I've got a good family, because they all came for my ordination.
I don't know.
So anyway, this is the website by Marcus on the beta I'm managing. So there you go. Okay. Yep.
Anda mayang sasna samudaya wada katam sadu karam dadama se sadu sadu
Bhagavato Sāṃ